Truth. He's not a good man. She doesn't answer. And words leave my mouth before I can stop them, which means they've been there, waiting, for a long time. Is Dusty a good man? I ask her. She draws a deep inhale, gets up, goes to the refrigerator, finds another bottle of wine. Then she goes to her purse, which is on another counter across the room, and looks for something, which she finds. And then she returns to her stool at the island and her wine and me. Here, she says, and she hands me a small slip of paper. I look at it. It's a deposit slip from the bank where I have my college fund. There's a deposit listed that I didn't make, and it's big. It's not as much as the scholarship Dusty helps steal from you, but I can get more, a little at a time. I stare at the number and realize it's the exact amount I counted in her lotion box when I checked on all the important things in this house. It's the money she's taken from Dusty when he wasn't looking. And now I think that she knew she might need it one day, and that her handing me this deposit slip is the answer to my question about whether Dusty is a good man. There is no good or bad. It's all relative. It all depends on the moment. A good man can become a bad man in the blink of an eye. I already know this. It's rule number 24. No one is all good and no one is all evil. I sit down beside her and wait for more. I know it's coming. Mr. Nelson, Jay was his first name, was not a bad man. He was a very good man when I was with him, and he struggled with our relationship. People can say what they want about it, but I pursued him. I wanted him. He was smart, and all the boys my age were so dumb. He made me think about things, you know? And dream about things. About college and a career, and yes, about marriage and kids too. He made it seem like I could do all of that. But then, things happened. I got pregnant with you. But he did not leave because of that. In fact, we decided to keep it a secret. And then after the school year, we were going to tell my parents and move away together where no one would know us. This is shocking to me. This is a different story than the one I've been telling myself. A better story. This was the kind of story that would have changed everything for me. Every single thing. But then he went on that trip with the seniors up in the mountains. He was one of the chaperones. He was supposed to be with the group when they went hiking. He was supposed to be up there with Coop and Ian's dad, Cullen, and the boy who died, Rudy Benton, and the others. The thing is, Charlie, Jay left the trip to meet me at the edge of the park. I drove there so we could be together for an afternoon. It was sweet, actually. He'd planned a picnic, and we went on our own walk by the lake. I was starting to show under my clothing by then, and he put his hand on my belly, on you. She stopped, then stared into her wine glass. She was waiting for me to make some kind of connection, but I was lost in this image of her with my father that was rewriting my entire life. Now I don't understand anything. So what happened? Why did he leave us? My mom sighs long and hard. Well, As you can imagine, all of the boy's parents and the whole community, really, wanted to know where Jay was when he was supposed to be on that steep trail with the boys. In fact, no one was supposed to be on that trail, and Jay could have stopped them from going up at all. He should have stopped them. But he wasn't there. He was with me. They asked where he went, and he said he went off on his own to go for a swim, which was bad enough, but not enough to get him fired. No. It was a student, Charlie. Another senior who saw us together. There was a group of girls who were spending the day at the lake instead of the trails. One of them spotted my car and then waited for me to come back. She hid behind a tree like a little spy. And when I did return, Jay was with me. He kissed me goodbye and then kissed my belly. And she saw all of it. And then she told the principal.
And then he got fired, I interject. Because he was with you instead of watching the boys, and then one of the boys died.
My mom nods her head. Who was it? I ask her. Who was that girl? When she says the name, a million pieces fall into place. Regina Cooper. Chapter 26. It's past 2 a.m. when I check the street one last time. For the mystery car that parks far away. For the black SUV. The danger feels surreal, like a story I've made up in my head. What is real to me now is what I've done to my mom by making her relive her terrible story. And what she's done to me by telling me a lie for my entire life. It wasn't love that ruined everything. It was a nosy teenage girl who ruined everything for both of us. My mom could have had a husband, a real one, the kind she could bear to look at. And I could have had a father, a real one, the kind who would love me. I walk past her room. The door is closed, the light is off, and there is no sound coming from the TV or from her crying. I go to my room and crawl into my bed and under the covers, and my mind finally goes quiet. I dream of my mom first. I'm 9 years old, and I smell her, the perfume and the makeup. I am on our bed in our shitty apartment, and I feel her eyelashes brush my cheek and her hand stroke my face. Then she leaves me. And I hear the door open and close and the key turn the deadbolt from the outside, and the fear creeps in. I dream of Ian next. We're under the hand of God. I tell him I love him and I don't care what happens because I feel good, so good. And I want to feel good just once. I want to feel like we are one, me and Ian, one body, one person. I want to feel like we're not alone. But someone is beside the truck. I can hear the rustling as he moves through the grass and brushes against the side. But then it sounds like my mom and her keys in the lock, metal on metal. And I want to go back to Ian and his body on mine and never have to leave, never be alone again. And then I am alone. Alone at the Triple S. Alone with Coop, and he comes closer to me in Nora's office. The safe is open, money spilling out of it, and he holds a pile of it up to my face and tells me to smell it, to smell the money, dirty, greasy money, and the spot on his head begins to shine with sweat. I wake from this dream and burst into consciousness. The room is empty. But my door is open. I always close my door. I sit up and turn on the light beside my bed.
It's then I see the mess they've made. Clothes taken from the drawers, pulled from the closet. Everything on my shelf is now on the floor in a giant heap. Books, towels, bags, hats, and my teddy bear with the missing batteries. They were here. They were here! The space between my bed and the door is only a few feet, but it looks like miles. I can't move. Not one muscle. I am frozen with fear. Why would they come at night, while I was here, while I was sleeping and could have woken to see them? Did they really think I would leave anything here for them to find? How stupid do they think I am? I am terrified. I am angry. I am losing my shit. Mom! I call out. I don't know where this comes from, this instinct to call for her. But I quickly regret it when I hear her door open and her feet running. Yes, running down the hall toward my room. Charlie? She calls out. Then she's there in the open doorway. What's happened? I open my mouth to tell her, but then I stop. They just did this to scare me. They knew they wouldn't find anything, but they wanted me to know they were here. That they can get to me anywhere, even inside my house, with my mom just down the hall. She comes to my bed and sits with me. She takes my hands, which are too shaky to tap or do anything else with.
Did you have a bad dream?
She asks. Now is the time. If I'm going to tell her about what's been happening these past few days, I have to do it now. I calculate her reaction. She will call the police. She will call Dusty. She will make sure everyone knows that her daughter and her home were invaded, and she will want heads to roll. Only they can't even see the heads they'd need to chop off. Not the police, not Dusty, not my mom, not even me. But I know who can. Yeah, I tell her. It was just a bad dream. She sighs as she climbs into my bed and cuddles up behind me like she used to in our shitty apartment. As I start to close my eyes, she says,
"Tomorrow you have to clean up. Everything is such a mess."
And I think she's right. Everything is a total mess.
Chapter 27.
Charlie! Over here! Get in the passenger side. Hello, Charlie. I'm so glad you called. I think we're a safe meeting here. I figured if I parked in the back of the mall, it would be pretty empty on a Tuesday morning. Looks like I was right. You know, someone told me this place was half closed. It's sad, really. Shows you the state of this town. So, how are you holding up? Why aren't you in school?
I called in sick. And I'm not good. Not good at all. He was in my room last night.
Who was in your room?
Barry. Or someone who works for him. They went through all my stuff looking for the cell phone in the contents of the safe.
Well, how do you know what they were looking for?
Because you told me. You said they wanted those things. You said that.
Okay, calm down. You're right. I'm just trying to help. Did you see them? Do you know who did this?
No, but...
Is there any chance it was a bad dream? Sometimes dreams can seem very real.
I think I would know if I'd left my room that way.
Who else was in the house? Could it have been one of your brothers?
Just my mom, and she was asleep. She would never do something like that to me. You're trying to confuse me now.
No, Charlie. I'm really not. I just want to make sure. Ah, this is very concerning. This means Barry is looking for something you have or trying to scare you. He's putting more pressure on. Did you call the police?
No. You said I couldn't trust the local police. And so did my lawyer. She said not to trust anyone.
Your lawyer? I didn't know you had a lawyer.
Well, I do. And she's smart. And drives a Mercedes. And wears navy pantsuits. She's helping me because she wants to. Even though she has fancy clients who aren't criminals.
Did you tell her that you have the cell phone and the things from the safe?
I never said I had them.
Oh, come on, Charlie. You reached out for my help, Someone obviously knows you have them, otherwise they wouldn't have been in your room. And I think they were trying to scare you more than anything else. They could easily sneak in there during the day when they're less likely to get caught.
Well, I am scared, but I'm not scared the way they want me to be.
What do you mean?
They can't hurt me if they think I have the things they want.
Well, I'm not totally sure about that, if I'm honest. Do you even know why they want those things? Maybe they aren't that important to them. Maybe at some point they'll decide to let them stay hidden. Then you will be in danger.
They want them, all right. There are numbers they need. Regina Cooper told me Coop hides things in storage somewhere. And I think the numbers lead to the hiding place.
How do you know they have numbers if you don't have them?
I have them, okay? But no one will ever find them if I don't want them found. My lawyer said I can use them to make a deal with you. That I can make you protect me and my friends if I hand them over.
Oh, she did, huh? And she also told you not to trust the local police.
Yes, and she's right.
And what do you think is in this hiding place?
I don't know. I assume it's money. The money Coop was cleaning for Barry.
You're starting to sound like an undercover agent yourself, Charlie.
Don't make fun of me.
I'm sorry, I wasn't making fun of you. It was a compliment. And you're right.
Yeah, okay.
It's probably money. But I can't tell you how much danger you're in unless you tell me how you got your hands on the cell phone and the things from the safe. I can't help you unless I know what you saw or heard that night while you were in the store. Because if Barry did kill Clay Cooper, then once you hand over the things he wants, he'll want you dead.
But my lawyer said you could protect me. She said I could make a deal with you, and you would arrest Barry, and then I would be safe. And I'd never have to say anything about what I saw or heard or didn't see and didn't hear.
Oh, gee. All right, this lawyer you have, what's her name?
Dana Blakely.
And what does she look like, besides the fancy suit and expensive car?
She wears her hair in a tight bun, and she's tall and thin, and I think most people would say she's pretty.
Okay. Hold on. I'm going to show you a picture on my phone. Just have to do a search. All right, here. Take the phone and tell me if this is your lawyer.
Yes, that's her.
Now look at the name under the picture.
No, this can't be right.
What does it say?
Daryl Romansky. Wait, I know that name. What is this? Where did you find this?
It's not Dana Blakely.
What?
That woman is named Daryl Romansky, and we've been tracking her movements for a while now.
Oh, my God.
She works for Clay Cooper and Barry. She helps them set up corporations so they can create the fake ones that supply the fake inventory that doesn't exist.
But she said she grew up here. She knew things about Sawyer, about high school, and my mom. Things no one would know, unless...
Unless they knew someone like Clay Cooper who told them. Or they did a little research.
But she was so convincing. I was so sure.
Charlie, how can I explain this? You know what a sociopath is, right?
Sure. Like serial killers?
Yes. But there are many kinds of sociopaths. And we have an entire training program that teaches us about them, what they're capable of. Because sociopaths are motivated by different things than people who commit crimes for money or revenge or power. And they all have one thing in common.
What?
They're exceptional liars. They don't react the way other people do when they lie. They don't get nervous or sweat or look away. In fact, they can't even fool lie detector tests.
So... You think Dana Blakely is a sociopath?
I'm just saying, she lied without you having any idea at all. She was convincing, you said. And we know she works for Barry. What kind of person lies to a kid?
But how did she know I would be at the station that day? That I would need a lawyer?
How did it happen that she ended up hiring her?
She was in the lobby. She said she was waiting for a client who got arrested on a DUI.
Uh-huh. That's very coincidental.
Regina Cooper told us to look there. She's the one.
Again, very coincidental. And I don't believe in coincidences.
No, this can't be happening. I thought
You thought what, Charlie? That you could trust people? This is the thing about places like Sawyer. Times are tough here. And when times are tough, alliances break down. Loyalty breaks down. There are no sides. No tribes, no laws. Just people pushing other people off lifeboats. And looting and corruption that reaches high and low and everywhere in between. Dog eat dog. Think about that expression, Charlie. What it means. When members of the same species break from their pack and fight to the death because there's not enough food to go around, every dog for himself. And now, here, in Sawyer, it's every man for himself.
I thought I had it all figured out. The rules!
Charlie, listen to me. I have a plan.
Chapter 28. I throw my bike in the back of the SUV and let Agent Zellman drive me to school. It's 9:30 and I've only missed first period, which is math, and I've already taken this class online and even taken the AP exam last spring, so I only go because all the seniors have to. Yes, this is where my mind is after it's been exploded by Agent Zellman's bomb. But I need to do something normal. I need to be in my normal life. Even though my mom told me to stay home and rest, even though Agent Zellman pleads as we drive. You're not safe, Charlie. They're coming out of the woodwork now, the people who want the money. And now that you've put all these pieces together, you know too much. But that lawyer will lead right to them, right to Barry and his associates. He thinks and nods and drives while I picture myself in history class, sitting next to ordinary kids with ordinary lives. He doesn't say the rest, which is that the only way to make me not know something is to kill me. And I think Clay Cooper was killed, wasn't he? And I bet he never thought it would happen. Not in a million years, the way he acted like such a big man, like nothing could ever touch him. What he does say, Agent Zellman, is that he has a plan, and his face lights up when he explains. Charlie, he says, glancing over at me, let us get her. Let us take down Daryl Romanski. She'll give up what she has on Clay Cooper and Barry. She's a low-level lawyer who's already proven she's willing to do what it takes to get what she wants, posing as Dana, whatever, trying to fool you. That's how we get her. That's how we get Barry. And that's how you get out of this mess. He tells me he'll call her, Dana Blakely, who's really Daryl Romanski, and set up a meeting with her and the FBI, just like she suggested. He says he'll find out what she wants before she'll let me talk to them and hand over the information from the phone and the safe. He says that she'll probably want to meet me first and see what I have, to hear my whole story. That's when you'll know. When she suggests bringing her the cell phone first, she'll say it's because she needs to know what to ask us for in the immunity agreement. She'll probably tell you to leave the phone with her and she'll keep it safe until we all meet and it's time to hand it over. Only she won't show up at that meeting, will she? She'll be out of town the second she has what she needs to get the money.
I think about this. I think about giving her the cell phone with the number and with it, all of my power.
Why wouldn't she kill me right then and there? I ask him. And it all sounds so stupid leaving my mouth, like I've made everything up.
Because we'll be right there with you.
We'll have eyes on both of you wherever she asks to meet, and we'll move in the second we sense danger.
He tells me she won't try to do anything out in the open, even if she is using a fake name here. People have seen her around town. No, if she wants to kill me, she'll have someone else do it. Or wait until I'm alone somewhere, like in the parking lot of the Triple S or riding my bike home from work. A car might take me out, something like that. And this is supposed to offer me comfort. I sit in history class next to a girl named Ginny and a boy named Kyle. and I do not fall asleep today, which is shocking. We're learning about the Electoral College system, and it's boring as anything. Next, the teacher will probably show us a video, and everyone will fall asleep. I sit there and think about the number on the cell phone, 345-6292-879-21704. It's the same number that was written on a piece of paper in the safe with a small pile of dirty, greasy cash. I've been thinking about this number and how it's separated by dashes, which means each piece is a different element. I think about places money can be hidden, places that require numbers. It's not an absolute location using longitude and latitude. The number doesn't make sense for that. Where would Coop feel safe leaving all that money? People hide money between their mattresses. They hide money beneath wooden floorboards and in air ducts and wrapped in tinfoil in their refrigerators. They hide money inside appliances they've taken apart and put back together. There must be a million other places. But this has to be a place Coop controlled, where he could come and go every week. I have to think about the numbers, but also about Coop. I've done my best to learn and to analyze, but my seesaw will always be lopsided because that's how it's built and that's what I will have to live with for my whole life. And never have I been more aware of that than I am right now, needing to understand a man like Clay Cooper as much as I understand the numbers hidden in his phone. I thought I'd been so clever with my rules and all of the information I'd gathered over so many years, but I will never do better than making it through a high school gym class. None of this will get me through real life because there's just too much to know. Things I can't get from books and TV shows. Intangible things that require intuition and an internal compass, the things I don't have, the side of my seesaw that's too light. I could not see through Dana Blakely. I trusted her. Frustration takes hold just as the bell rings and class ends, and I put all of that aside because now I have to do something else. I step into the hallway and pull out my phone. First, I call Dana Blakely and ask if she's heard from Agent Zellman. She tells me that he contacted her and that we should meet first to prepare. She says how relieved she is and gives me an address for some shared office space her firm uses. She asks me if I'm okay, and I picture the caring smile I know she would give me if we were face to face, and I want to claw it off of her. Just as Zellman predicted, she tells me to bring the cell phone so she can see what I have first and then be able to make a better deal for me. She's lied to me, and I never saw it coming because she was supposed to be like me, a woman who'd changed her destiny by escaping where she'd come from. She was supposed to be on my side. I even Googled her firm, which had what looked like a real website with clients and other lawyers, but now I think, how hard can it be to make a fake website with fake pictures? That's on me. That's the world we're in. Even though we have steak sandwiches and tobacco and the hand of God offering salvation, it's just not enough. Everyone is trying to get what they can, and the liars are having a field day with us. The second thing I do is text Agent Zellman and tell him I've done it, and that we have a date tomorrow after school. That should give him time to set up his surveillance to make sure Dana Blakely doesn't kill me. He confirms right away and tells me he will protect me and I shouldn't worry. But I am worried, because what kind of shit for brains uses a 17-year-old girl who's standing outside her history class to catch what seems to be a pretty mediocre, low-level crime lord named Barry, who's dumb enough not to have a plan to get his money back, and who goes into business with Clay Cooper in the first place? Clay Cooper, who ogles teenage girls and takes them on dates at the Marriott Hotel the second they turn 18, and who sweats just thinking about it. A man who won't even use a bank or have insurance, who keeps important information on a cell phone that could fall out of his pocket at any moment. How dumb is it to leave that much money in a place where it might get lost forever? He couldn't be that dumb. He was a shitbag, but he managed to hide all this money in the first place, so he must know how to do some things. I think then that Coop wouldn't do this. He wouldn't leave a string of numbers that his wife would have to decode if he died, unless she knew how to decode it. Unless she knew what the dashes were separating. Yes, that has to be it. Regina Cooper knows what the numbers correlate to. She has to know the code. But there's no way she can get to the money without the number. She needs both. And what all of this means is that she's been lying to me too. People are shitty. I think about Mr. Nelson and my grandmother screaming those hateful words and leaving our things outside for the garbage collector. I think about two-chinned Dusty sitting at the head of the table who voted away my scholarship because I'm a girl who can't do anything but study and make sandwiches. I think about Coop and Regina and Barry and Dana Blakely and even Agent Selman. And now I am disgusted by everyone and everything in the whole entire world. I'll never rely on rule number 31 again. Trust but verify. There's a new rule now. Rule number 0. The golden rule. Trust no one. I hear the bell. Science is next. I will swallow my anger and pretend to learn facts about physics that I already know. Then I will ride my bike to the SSS and make sandwiches all night. I'll restock the pans and rotate them and make the list for the morning. And then I'll clean the grill and mop the floors and accept a hug from Janice and a nod of encouragement from Nora. As I walk down the hall to the science room, I miss Keller more than I can even believe. I want to find her, sneak a cigarette on her roof, hear about her night with Levi, tell her about sleeping in Ian's bed, make fun of lazy Tracy, and laugh until Dot calls and we have to flick the cigarette and pretend we have no idea why we smell like smoke, and then laugh. That's the way it should be. And the way it will be, at least for Keller. I promise myself this as I take my seat in the classroom. Chapter 29. The next morning, I leave the house before the sun is up. I stop by the SSS to rotate the stock in the refrigeration units because it has to be done properly and only I can do that. Nora almost laughs at me because she knows I can't stop myself from being meticulous and careful. I tell her it makes me feel like there is some order in the world even when there is no order. Where one day you're clocking into work and the next day your boss is dead. When I'm at school, I'm on autopilot, sitting in math, then science, then history, and at lunch and walking down the halls, and then in French and computer science, and then at my locker shoving everything inside because I'm not doing homework tonight, I think about the things I have told to Dana Blakely, aka Daryl Romansky, and the things I have told to Agent Zellman, and the things that Barry knows about me, like the fact that I hold the key to finding the money. I don't exactly have the whole afternoon figured out. I know my mom will be at the hair salon getting blonder, which takes 3 hours. The house will be empty. I know Dusty and my brothers will be at the kids' cabin because Dusty paid for one more night and they don't offer refunds, so even if Dusty was turning into a shriveled prune from the water park, he would not come back and lose his deposit on the room. I know I've done everything I can possibly do to make it out of this situation. And still, my heart is bursting, my head is burning, and I feel like the person they are going to expect me to be. A girl who's good for nothing except math and making sandwiches. Yesterday, Dana Blakely gave me the address for an office on the far end of the downtown strip. It's called Sawyer Executive Suites. It's a brand new building, and it even has a bike rack where I park my bike and let my backpack slide off one shoulder. She says her firm rents one office there in some kind of timeshare agreement, and I don't question her because I know she's probably lying. Rule number 0, the golden rule, trust no one. There are signs for a real estate broker outside, the kind with the giant head of the agent, with bright white teeth and a friendly smile and a colorful scarf. Always the scarf, because it makes the agent look professional but non-threatening. No one has ever been intimidated by a woman in a scarf. No one has ever wanted to have sex with a woman wearing a scarf either. She feels like a safe choice for clients of all genders and ages. I think about this as I walk to the entrance of the building, even though I should be thinking about the fact that I did not see a van or a black SUV or anything out on the street that looked like it could be Agent Zellman to keep watch over me. But there's no turning back. The parking lot has just two cars. One of them is a red Subaru, and the other is the white Mercedes sedan that Dana Blakely was driving the day she was waiting at the Triple S. The day she made me trust her and believe she wanted to help me and got me to tell her about the cell phone and the money and Agent Zellman. The back of the building is thick with woods and then a stream, so I doubt Agent Zellman is parked there, but I can't stop now. I am prepared to do what needs to be done, which is to lie to this liar with the pantsuit and black pumps and tight bun to get what I need. The offices in the building are mostly empty. I open the door and check the board that lists the businesses. There are 8 of them, from physical therapists to shrinks to a Pilates studio, individual companies. And yet no one is in the lobby. I think about the real estate agent with the scarf, and I wonder if she made up all of these businesses herself so that when people see the sign, they don't know that the building is empty and then think that maybe it's a shitty building. Dana Blakely said she was using office 2C, which is on the 2nd floor, so I stand in front of the elevator bank and push the button. It dings. I get inside. I hit the number 2 and the doors close, and then up I go, one flight. The doors open to a floor that is just as quiet as the first, except that the hum from the traffic is even softer here. I see just 3 offices. 2 doors are closed and have no names on them. The 3rd is slightly open, and when I walk over, I see a gold sign that reads 2C, and I remind myself not to be fooled when I see her. She is not who she says she is. She is Daryl Romanski, and she wants to trick me into giving her the cell phone. I knock on the door, and this makes it swing open slowly, softly. No hint of a squeak because it's brand new, but also hollow. As nice as everything looks in this building, it is cheaply made. Even the elevator jiggled like something that could break at any moment. The door opens to a gray speckled carpet and a light wood desk with a huge paper calendar and a phone, an actual phone with a cord that runs down to the wall, and a chair behind the desk that is some kind of black vinyl and looks like it might swivel. A leather bag sits on the vinyl chair, and I recognize it from that day at the police station. I stand there and look inside and wonder now if maybe she's gone to the ladies' room, which I saw down the hall. Or maybe this is all a trick. I step inside and check behind the door. Nothing. Just a file cabinet and a fake plant that sits on top of it. My heart settles because the office is empty. And then I realize that this is my chance to see whatever's inside the leather bag. I decide to leave the door open because then I will hear her when she comes out of the ladies' room or out of the elevator or even from the stairwell. You could hear a pin drop in here. I step closer to the desk and place my backpack on one of the chairs. My eyes go first to the bag, but then I see something else, which is so strange. It takes a very long moment to register. Blood. First, I think it's a design on the gray carpet, and then a stain from a leak somewhere, but then what could be leaking that looks like ketchup? And then it hits me, and I freeze. I walk around the desk slowly. The large file cabinet is in front of the stain, between me and the window that looks out to the woods. My heart is in my throat. That's a dumb expression, But there's a reason for it, which I now understand. Every vein in my body is opening up to allow adrenaline to race through so I can protect myself like an animal in the wild facing a predator. Only I am not the one facing anything, except what waits for me behind this file cabinet in this empty room. The blood forms a circle on the gray carpet, and right in the middle of the circle is a black high heel pump. Chapter 30. I don't remember taking my eyes off of the shoe. I don't remember picking up my backpack from the chair on the other side of the desk, or running from the office, or down the stairs, or out the front door to my bike. But I do all of those things, because suddenly I am in front of the convenience store where there are people and cars driving by. I call Agent Zellman and tell him what happened and ask where the hell was he? He was supposed to be close by watching with the team from the FBI. And then he was supposed to come in if there was any trouble, which I think this would qualify. Calm down, Charlie. Tell me what's happened. I have trouble finding the breath to say words. There was blood in her shoe. I think someone killed her. He is shocked. He tells me that his team is at a different address, another building owned by the same company and with the exact same name, Sawyer Executive Suites. They have more than one location, and I didn't know. I didn't bother to check. Charlie, we thought you didn't show. I must be panting into the phone because Agent Zellman tells me to calm down, take a deep breath, and then I manage to give him the address of the building where I've just found Dana Blakely's blood and shoe, and he tells me two things. First, he says, we're on our way now. Second, he says, we need to take you in. You're not safe. He tells me to get home and lock the doors. And I say, won't I be safer out in public? And he says, no, that's not true at all. That's a myth. Something on TV. Go home and lock the doors. He says he'll meet me there as soon as he checks out the scene at the other office. I agree to go back to my house, but I don't leave right away. First, I call Ian. He doesn't pick up, so I just leave a crazy message about a dead lawyer in an empty office building and the FBI. I hold the phone in my hand, thinking, what else can I do? Who else can I call for help? And I run through the list of everyone from my mom to Nora to Janice and even to Dusty. My fingers hit buttons, then stop. They do this again and again and again until I finally accept what I have to do now. Think. I have to think. I have to think about numbers and rules. Numbers and rules. Numbers and rules. I think while I ride my bike. I let part of my brain count the pedals. I make them into a pattern. Three fast, two slow. Two fast, three slow. It wakes up the other side, the analytical side, which needs to get to work. I go through my rules. Number 10, about impulsive behavior. Number 11, about emotions and rational decisions. Number 4, about feelings and brain chemicals. And I come to the conclusion that I have to calm my brain so I can stop feeling scared, stop being emotional. Think, don't feel. Think. Don't feel. I make a new calculation in my mind. I list facts in one column, only things I know to be true. Things I have seen with my eyes and heard with my ears and that cannot be untrue. There aren't many of those. Some of the ones I begin to put there I have to take away when I ask myself the question, could this be untrue? And if so, how? And if so, why? The column grows longer as my brain allows memories to resurface. Small things. Things I didn't even think to hold on to, but for some reason did. In the next column are facts that don't add up. that have been contradicted by other things in the first column. Too fast, three slow, Agent Zelman's car keys. Three fast, too slow, sandwiches and inventory, real and fake. All fast now, faster and faster and faster as I see the number from Coop's phone and the number written on that piece of paper and then all of the street signs I ride past. Regina Cooper knows the code. She has to. There is no chance she would make heads or tails of this number unless she knew how to decode it. She thinks the government is going to steal her money. She has no idea where Coop keeps records. These are not the kind of things she's ever had to think about. Coop would make sure she had instructions. The calculation is nearly finished when I get back to Dusty's house and I run out of time. It will have to be enough, what I have sorted out. It just will. I wait now, in Dusty's house, in the dining room, by the window, where I can see the street, but the street can't see me because of where I'm standing. The doors are all locked, and the alarm is on. I call the hair salon and make sure my mom is there, and they tell me that she just sat down at the sink, which means they haven't even started, and it takes 3 hours to do all the things she has to have done. I call the police station and ask to speak to Ian, but they tell me he's in an all-day training program, which explains why he hasn't called me back. I think that this is not good, and I ask them to tell him to check his messages from me. It's important. Dusty has a grandfather clock, and it sits in the corner of the dining room and makes a tick-tock sound with every second that passes, and a ding with every minute, and a chime with every hour. It tick-tocks and dings and tick-tocks and dings, and I feel like I might take one of the candlesticks from the center of the table and just go and smash it to pieces. I am not in a good state of mind. It has only been 5 days. 5 days since everything changed. When my simple plan to get out of here and go to college was derailed by one man and a chain of events that I still cannot believe. I think about this while I wait, watching for Agent Selman's SUV, waiting for Ian to call. I think about every action I've taken since I got that first text from Keller at 8:52 Friday night. Everything I haven't told a soul and never, ever will. I think through it all, making sure I haven't missed anything in my calculations. No mistakes. No mistakes. No mistakes. Chapter 31. The Night of the Murder. I was at the Triple S working the dinner shift until close. We close at 10 every night except Sunday. I was in the back at the sink filling the mop bucket. The night was slow, just a few trickles of customers, and Tracy was handling those while I started the cleaning because I'm much better at the cleaning than he is. The bucket fits in the sink, but if you fill it more than halfway, it's too heavy to get out, so I did that. I filled it halfway and then turned off the water. That's when I heard the ping on my phone. Need you. It was from Keller. That's all it said. But then another came. Now. Please come now. When are you coming? I dried my hands and texted back. On my way. It was just me and Tracy, and he didn't know how to close the store. I texted Nora and asked if we could stay open until 11. I asked Tracy if he could stay until then in case I needed more time with Keller. I told him if he did, I would cover his Saturday night shift that he'd been complaining about all week. 2 weekend dinner shifts on the same weekend was more than he could tolerate because he was missing all the fun smoking weed with his loser friends. I told him I might even get back faster if I could borrow his car. That was a bigger problem, but he still agreed. He gave me his keys and I left. Just like that, with the bucket in the sink, my apron on the counter, and the back door open. Keller lives about 10 minutes from the Triple S, and I got there in 8. I could hear the screaming when I pulled up to the curb and turned off the engine. Levi's car was not on the street or in the driveway. Keller's car was parked under the covered carport. Lights were on upstairs and downstairs and everywhere throughout the house. I ran to the front door and it opened right up. The screaming was coming from the back, from the kitchen. It was the screaming of girls, women, fighting. The words were familiar.
"You're a whore!
Stop it, Dottie, stop!
Whore, whore, whore!"
I ran toward the voices. They were coming from the kitchen, and they did not stop when I got there, when Keller and Dot saw me. Instead, they pulled me in.
"She's a whore,"
Dot said to me, though her eyes were glued to Keller. She held a small cast iron pan in her right hand. Keller was in the corner, pinned to the wall by Dot's left hand, which was around her throat. The old woman's walker was on the ground. The oxygen tank had rolled away into the corner, and she'd pulled off the attachment that usually fits beneath her nose. She could barely stand, but that didn't stop her. Keller is smaller than Dot, but twice as strong. She could have blown Dot off of her with one breath. Still, she wasn't doing anything to protect herself. I had witnessed this before, the fighting, when Dot lost her senses and thought Keller was her mother, but I had never seen Dot lay a hand on Keller. "Dottie, this is Keller, remember? And I'm Charlie," I say, trying to pull her back. But she hadn't gone anywhere. Not this time.
"I know exactly who this is, and she's a whore just like her mother was a whore. All whores!"
Keller was wearing going-out clothes. High heels, a short tube dress with a low V-neck, and her mascara was running down her cheeks, just like my mom's the night we ran from that house. The house where another old woman was screaming that word at us. "Whore." Dot raised her left hand, the one with the frying pan, and bashed it against Keller's thigh. And I knew right then who'd been hurting Keller all along. Not Levi. Not Clay Cooper. Dot. Her grandmother. The frail old woman with the failing memory and foul mouth and hatred for her own dead daughter. And Keller did nothing to protect herself.
"Stop it!"
I yelled, rushing toward the old woman, grabbing the frying pan. I pulled her off Keller and saw the damage she'd already done to her face and her neck and the other leg. She came away easily, like a rag doll. And I wondered why Keller hadn't pushed her, even a little, to get away. Why she let Dot beat her and hold her throat and call her a whore. Why she'd been letting her do this for years, causing bruises so bad and so often that Janice had called the police to report the abuse. With Dot in my arms now, the frying pan on the floor, and Keller huddled in the corner, I almost asked her, because it was that kind of question. The kind that is so big you can't hold it inside. But then, somehow, I knew. This was how Keller lived with herself and the way she let Coop look at her and touch her and ogle her so she could keep her job. This was her penance. The thing she had to allow to balance the seesaw in her brain and the one side that hated itself for what it tolerated from Coop. "Let's get you a pill and get you to bed," I told Dot. And I coaxed her upstairs, got her a pill, and brought her to the bathroom so she could pee and wash her hands and put on a clean diaper. Then I tucked her into bed the way Keller always did, with the tight covers and the bed rails. Dot never stopped saying the words, but I had stopped caring.
"Whore, whore, whore."
because she was an old, senile woman, and if she understood what Keller did for her, what she'd had to do so Dot wasn't shoved into a state hospital and given the wrong medication that made her want to kill herself, maybe she would shut up about the whore business. Maybe she would just shut the hell up, period. I found Keller downstairs, still in the kitchen, a glass of something brown in her hand. Jack Daniels, it turned out. Something horrible happened, was how she began her story. Then she lit a cigarette. Keller never smoked in the house, but tonight, as I would soon learn, had called for breaking all the rules. Every last one. Chapter 32. Now. I'm lost in these thoughts when I hear the creak of a floorboard. I know every sound in this house after 8 years of living in it, so I know it's not just the wood settling from a change of temperature. It's the creak the floor makes when a person has stepped on it. But I haven't heard the alarm. I haven't heard the locks turn or the garage door open. I get up from the table and walk slowly to the wall by the clock, and I hide behind it. I don't make a sound. I know how to walk in this house undetected. The floor creaks again. Then a pause. Then again, my heart is in my throat. I am not prepared for a sneak attack. Another creak, and then another, until I see a shadow, and then a shoulder, and then a body enter the room. I step out from behind the clock because it doesn't hide me well enough. I've been seen. I stand straight and pretend to be unshaken when I hear someone say,
"Hello, Charlie."
Chapter 33. The Night of the Murder. I wanted a drink. I wanted a cigarette. But I wanted to help Keller more, so I sat down and told her to sit down too, but she couldn't. She was wired like I had never seen her before. So I got up and walked to the sink and wet a dish towel, and then went to where she was, leaning against the counter, and began to wipe the tears and blood and mascara from her face. "Tell me," I said. She was shaking head to toe, her nerves unable to settle.